طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin with news out of Palestine, and of course, it is not good news. We constantly review the news reports out of the West Bank and Gaza, and there is a sickening repetition to it. News of the daily shootings of Palestinians by the Israeli military and Jewish settlers, day in and day out, news of the land confiscation and the discriminatory application of the law. We try not to become numb to this repetition. We dare not become numb. Here are just a few stories from this past week to again jar us into paying attention to the magnitude of the systematic genocide taking place day in and day out, week in and week out, month by month, year by year in the West Bank and Gaza. We begin with a report from Hebron. 13-year-old Mohammed Irsaid thought his older brother had only been shot in the leg when he arrived alone to the hospital and asked for his brother's room number. The police officer at the front desk just looked at me and said, "Your brother isn't in a room. He's a martyr now," Mohammed told Middle East Eye a few hours later in the morning hall where friends and family were gathering to show their respects for the young man. It's the second time in less than 2 months that Mohammed has found himself in the same hall mourning a sibling. Israeli forces shot Uday Irsaid, 24, in the chest and leg during clashes in Hebron City on Friday, killing him just 6.5 weeks after his sister Danya Irsaid, 17, was shot dead at the same city center. Mohammed is now the oldest of his 4 remaining siblings. He and his brother spent most of their time together. At home, they shared a room, and together they ran the family's small bakery in the center of town. Dania, he said, was the oldest sister and took care of him like a mother. One family, 3 children killed in a matter of weeks. How would you like to come home to find your house occupied by the military that now lay claim to it? This happens all the time in the West Bank. Here is the latest report. For the last 15 days, a family in Hebron have had no access to the top 2 floors of their house, which was illegally taken over by the Israeli occupation forces and where they set up a military base. 10 Israeli soldiers suddenly showed up at the house in the neighborhood of Abu Shinay in Hebron. They broke in by smashing a window in the door, took the key, and demanded that the family vacate the 3rd floor. The soldiers did not have any documentation to explain or justify the incursion, nor did they give an explanation to the family why their house was being taken over. Any questions are ignored, and the 3rd floor as well as the rooftop are now off limits to the family. Since the soldiers arrived, they have broken the windows and shot holes in the water tank which supplies clean water to the household. They then took all the blankets on the premises and used them to dry the water leaking from the tanks. The family also reported that once the water supply was fixed, the soldiers contaminated the water and used the apartment and roof as a toilet. The soldiers never leave the apartment empty, but a few times per day there is a shift change. This happens at different times every day, so there is no knowing when, and the soldiers move in and out as they please anyway. This means there can be soldiers moving throughout the building at any time, terrifying the family, especially the young children, who no longer dare to leave the house on their own. The soldiers use the roof as a lookout and also frequently fire weapons such as tear gas from there into the surrounding neighborhood. The three-story family house is home to 13 people, now crowded into two small floors, including a young disabled child. They have no idea how long the soldiers will stay or if the family will ever get their house back at all. And finally, a review of the week from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Last week, 10 Palestinian civilians, including a child, were killed in the West Bank. 70 Palestinian civilians, including 21 children, a female journalist, and a woman, were wounded in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israeli forces put into effect the house demolition policy on grounds of a collective punishment. A house in Nablus was bombed, due to which a mosque and five nearby houses sustained material damage. A number of houses were surveyed, and their occupants were threatened to leave their houses to be demolished. Israeli forces continue to target the border area along the Gaza Strip. Two houses sustained damage because of the Israeli shells. Israeli warplanes raided a training site in the Gaza Strip, but no casualties were reported. Israeli forces conducted 114 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank just this past week, while 10 Massachusetts senators were visiting Israel on an all-expenses-paid junket sponsored by the Jewish Community Relations Council. You can bet your bottom dollar they did not read about these issues in the Israeli press as they reveled in their public relations tour. Our feature presentation this morning is a conversation between Princeton Professor Emeritus Richard Falk, who also served as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Rights, and Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, and founder of the Electronic Intifada, that took place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The conversation followed a lecture delivered by Professor Falk. Their appeal to rationality and diplomacy in the face of failed military approaches to problem-solving in the Middle East is the kind of discussion and approach to conflict resolution that one wishes would take place amongst our so-called diplomats on the international stage. But alas, pure military response continues to dominate as the solution to the Middle East conflict. Here are Richard Falk and Ali Abu Nima from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I'm going to start where you ended. You gave a very compelling argument that there's a pattern in history, especially since World War II, of the underdog who has right on their side winning. Why can't people in power see that?
I think that's a very important issue that I've thought about a lot. And I think the simplistic but still instructive answer is because our bureaucracy and our media have become so militarized over the course of this period since the end of World War II and subsequent decades, that it's both impolitic and unnatural to think outside the military box. And so we keep in reinventing how to win these conflicts that are occurring in the global south. And if you notice the response to Syria and to ISIS or to the Paris attacks, it's always one of let's do more militarily. There's very little freedom of the political imagination to consider non-military ways of resolving conflict. And that's partly because the military budget has remained so high. It's partly because the think tanks in Washington are very capable of sustaining this kind of ideological outlook. I had as a student some years ago David Petraeus, who made his reputation by reinventing counterinsurgency warfare. That is, trying to say what happened in Vietnam was an anomaly and that we could fix it by treating the civilian population of the target society in a more understanding way and by shifting our tactics using new technologies, drones being the most dramatic example, and finding ways to make the military instruments successful and effective as part of the global domination strategy being pursued by Washington.
Well, today as we speak, the British Parliament voted to send the UK's two or three remaining warplanes into Syria. There was a big debate about that. Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, who is a long-time anti-war activist and supporter of Palestinian rights, spoke eloquently and I think sensibly about the long history of not just the failure of war, but its tendency to produce more violence. And yet, a majority voted yet again for more bombing. Are there alternatives to bombing?
Yes, of course. I should have said in my earlier answer that it's not just the political establishment that has learned to think within this military box. It's also the political consciousness that has governed Western understandings of security. And it is deeply embedded in our own society, and one dimension of it is the gun culture. We think, we identify in a very dysfunctional way the power to destroy with the ability to be secure. And that's a very false identification. Now, we are capable of doing something other than this if it's not seen as an immediate threat. For instance, we have been talking privately to the Taliban in Afghanistan with the idea of trying to find a political formula that is an alternative to what would otherwise seem to be permanent warfare in the country. So one can ask, why can we talk to the enemy in Afghanistan, but not in these other settings? Why do we treat Hamas differently than the Taliban? Or why do we not even consider that there may be grievances that these groups have? I have mentioned sometimes a presentation that John Major made about his diplomacy in Northern Ireland, where he said that he only made progress in reaching some kind of ceasefire and accommodation in Northern Ireland when he stopped thinking of the IRA as a terrorist organization and began realizing that they were a political actor that had grievances, and if those grievances were addressed, diplomacy was possible.
To come back to the question of international law, you gave in your remarks a very comprehensive indictment of the failure of the United Nations on the question of Palestine. And I know that I, like many others, will continue to cite this UN resolution or that UN resolution, or point out how many resolutions are being breached by Israeli settlements or the siege of Gaza or any number of other practices. In your role as UN Special Rapporteur, your role was to investigate, to present the results objectively of what you found, and to recommend action. It must have been very frustrating for you to see those recommendations so consistently ignored or set aside. So I have two questions. Can you tell us some of the inner workings of how the pressure within the UN works? And secondly, how do you retain, or do you retain, any faith in the possibility of international law after being UN Special Rapporteur and dealing with Israel?
No, those are important, quite searching questions. Let me say two things at first. The UN is no better or worse than the behavior of its most important members. That's people forget that.
And that's Micronesia and the Marshall Islands.
But it's also Libya. See, when geopolitical forces want the UN to be effective, it can be very effective, maybe too effective. But when the geopolitical forces, as has been the case over the years with Palestine, are trying to resist UN authority, then UN authority cannot be implemented behaviorally. But it's very important, my second point is, it's very important to recognize that the UN, despite its limitations in implementing in a behaviorally relevant way these resolutions that you refer to, it has a great deal of symbolic leverage. It is the most important venue for resolving claims about what is just in the world. And the whole buildup of the global solidarity movement has rested in large part, or I'd say in significant part, on the fact that it is reinforced by international law and by UN authority. The UN is a failure for Palestine behaviorally, but it's a success, an important asset for the Palestinian struggle symbolically. And that's why Israel and indirectly the U.S. get so furious with the UN. If it mattered not at all, it would be ignored. The Israelis are not stupid. They understand, and they've made a great emphasis in recent years on what they call the delegitimation project as threatening to their future security. And the delegitimation project is essentially saying we're losing the struggle to control the moral and legal heights, and that has political implications. What those implications are remains to be seen. It doesn't always come out the way one would like it to come out. And I sometimes refer to Tibet as a leading example where the Dalai Lama has led a successful legitimacy war on behalf of the Tibetan people, but the geopolitical forces are too strong to overcome, and so China has successfully maintained its position of dominance and control. So I think what it's important to understand, both for the UN and international law, is its limitations, but also its usefulness. And one has to think in very concrete and sometimes in institutional terms about where it can be useful. Also, what is the role of civil society? Civil society activism on the Palestinian issue, I think, relies very much on the congruence between its objectives and the sense of what is morally and legally right.
You've talked about that struggle, you write about it, that what you call the legitimacy war or legitimacy struggle. You've spoken and written about that, and the role of civil society activism, particularly boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is a Palestinian-led movement that began a decade ago and is, to a large extent, modeled on the kind of sanctions and boycott and pressure that was put on apartheid South Africa. There's been a counter attack, let's say, by Israel, not surprisingly, and by Israel lobby groups. But it's included in recent, in the past year or two, legislative efforts in various state legislatures and in the U.S. Congress to limit this movement. Is boycott, divestment, and sanctions a legitimate set of tactics? Is it free speech? And what legitimacy do these legislative and other efforts have to suppress it?
Well, I think there's no doubt in my mind that until the relevance of what I was calling the special relationship entered the process, no one questioned the legality and legitimacy of boycott and divestment, nonviolent tactics designed to express a political and moral point of view. There was much opposition to the use of these tactics in the South African context, including at my university at Princeton. The Board of Trustees and the President were very much opposed to it, but no one even thought to question its legality as a tactic. It was a political issue. Was it more important to keep the investments of the university free from moral and political concerns, or was it more important to show solidarity with the struggle against apartheid? It was seen in those terms. And if, in a way, it's an extension, your question is an extension of my main presentation. This is the domestic, deforming repercussions of the special relationship. We wouldn't do this with any other country, probably not even with Saudi Arabia. It is only because of this status that Israel has achieved that we're willing to undercut our own traditions of civil liberties and human rights in order to insulate this special relationship from the kind of pressures that are being mounted.
I don't know if it's a challenge, but throw something else in on this question of the special relationship. There's no doubt that there is a special relationship. There's no doubt that the Israel lobby exercises tremendous power and influence in this country, particularly on political elites. We see that in the crushingly lopsided votes taken in Congress in, any time during the war on Gaza, for example, when Israel was killing 11 children a day in Gaza in the summer of 2014. But at the same time, there are signs of fractures, and I want to give you a couple and see what you make of them. There were a number of polls during Israel's attack on Gaza in the summer of 2014 that showed that major subgroups of the U.S. population opposed what Israel was doing. That included the Democratic Party base. It included young people, and it included people of color. And one of the stark examples of that was a Gallup poll that showed that people over 30 supported Israel's attack on Gaza by, I think, 51% to 25. But for under 30s, it was the reverse, the complete reverse. So that's one indicator. Again, there's a trend in the polling that we see. Another is that when Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States, I think in March, to give his speech to Congress, 60 members of Congress boycotted it, which is unprecedented. And then in the battle waged over the deal with Iran, the Israel lobby is seen as having completely lost that battle. Is that just a limited difference between Israel and the United States, or does it portend some kind of bigger shift?
Well, I think it's a mixture of the two. I think there is a shift in the political consciousness of the people in living in this country, particularly the young, as that poll indicates. And I've noticed in my own experience that those that support Israel are much less inclined than they were a few years ago to engage on the substance of issues that are raised, like the argument over the invasion of the attack on Gaza in 2014. And in a way, that gap between the shifting public opinion and the failure to make any commensurate adjustment in Washington illustrates part of the problem to me. It's very hard to translate changing. I think the American public would accept a normal relationship with Israel at this time, but the Beltway wouldn't. And it's finding a way to create a new situation where Washington gets the message. And it's a message in the interest of even the American strategic objectives in the world. It's not a radical message, actually. It would serve the cause of the Kissingers of this world to deal with Israel as a normal country and to seek a genuine political accommodation. Your other two examples, the Netanyahu, the walkout of the 60 senators, you have to put that in the context that this was an outrageous intrusion on American political normalcy. To have a foreign leader come to a joint session of Congress and attack a principal foreign policy objective of the elected president just before his own election. The fact that the rest of the Congress stayed there and applauded is what seems to me to be the most salient feature of that event. The outrage of allowing this kind of presentation, of sabotaging a very important foreign policy initiative that was not only an American initiative. All five of the permanent members of the Security Council were supportive of the move to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue in this way, plus Germany. And again, the agreement itself was so strongly supported by the Western alliance and by the major powers in the world that that even the special relationship couldn't stand up successfully in opposition to it. But again, I think it's a moment in that special relationship that's like an unexpected change in the direction of the current. Since the agreement, the U.S. has gone out of its way to reassure Israel that nothing has changed. It sent a high official, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, to make as nice as possible with Netanyahu in Tel Aviv. It has offered Israel even more military assistance than the $3 billion that we already
give. They're talking, I think, about renewing. I think they do the U.S. military aid deal on a 10-year term. So what's being published is that they're talking about renewing it from 2017 for $5 billion a year.
Yeah, right. See, and that's all so-called compensation for the fact that we didn't do what Israel wanted us to do, which would have been horribly destructive of stability. I shouldn't say stability, but it would have contributed to intensification of the turbulence and the danger of real spreading regional war in the Middle East. And it would have been a great blow to American leadership of the Western alliance, because the European countries very much wanted this agreement. So my sense is that the special relationship is alive and well, and that nothing fundamental has changed.
I want to, in your opening remarks, you said something that appears, I think, does make a lot of sense, that with all the regional turmoil and the calamities that are going on for so many people in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, and other in Yemen, that in a sense the focus has moved away from Palestine. You also pointed out that the longevity of what Palestinians have been enduring for decade upon decade. I want to put something different to you, that Israel is, in a sense, central to so much of what is happening, and I mean it in a specific sense. Israel has been offering a very specific narrative, the one that you offer in terms of your analysis based on international law, looking at Palestinian rights, making comparisons with Northern Ireland or South Africa, which says, in a very simplified way, there is an injustice, there are grievances. If you resolve them politically and give people their due, then conflict goes away. It can diminish, and eventually you can have peace. The narrative that Israel and many of its supporters in the United States are offering, and you saw this after the Paris attacks recently and after so many incidences, no, this isn't about Palestinian rights. This is a civilizational war between the democratic, rational, liberal West, of which Israel is the vanguard, and the savage, barbaric, extremist, irrational East. And that narrative has been around for a long time, but it seems to be taking root more and more broadly. Do you see that? And what can we do to resist it and to defeat this notion that we are destined to permanent civilizational and religious war?
No, well, you formulate that issue, which is, I think, a very central issue in a very clear and useful way. I think every time a spectacular terrorist incident occurs of the sort that occurred in Paris, the Israeli leadership tries to say, that's what we're up against. You know, it tries to associate ISIS phenomenon with the Palestinian struggle. And Netanyahu was explicit in saying that. Sharon, after the 9/11 attack, said, Yasser Arafat is our Osama bin Laden. You know, creating that kind of equation. And it really builds on the Samuel Huntington Clash of Civilizations hypothesis that was set forth in the early 1990s. And I think the only way of getting beyond that is by exposing its essentially polemical character. That if you look closely at the Palestinian struggle, you'll see that it has pursued reasonable goals in a way that is proportional to what justice and law would prescribe. And it has very little to do with political extremism. Even Hamas, when it entered the political process in 2006, at the urging, interestingly, of Washington, I think made a fundamental decision that they would pursue their goals by political means. And they basically abandoned an armed struggle scenario. That didn't mean they abandoned the option of responding to violence with whatever means they possessed. But it does mean that they didn't look to liberation or Palestinian emancipation through some kind of liberation. And they've indicated that they would settle for a 50-year coexistence arrangement provided Israel withdrew to 1967 borders. So it seems to me that that effort to portray the Palestinian struggle as an example of the problem of containing political extremism is just a way of manipulating ideologically the real situation. You say, what can we be done about it? I think it was somebody on the Supreme Court that said long ago, truth is the best disinfectant. And I think that's what meetings like this seek to do, is to get beyond the polemical and propagandistic ways of understanding violence and conflict in the world and examine where are the constructive opportunities that will lead us in the direction of sustainable peace.
Thank you so much for your insight. Thank you for the question.
That was Richard Folk and Ali Abunima in conversation from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And finally, we will close with a Palestinian voice, that of Ayman Odeh. Ayman Odeh is an Arab-Israeli lawyer and politician. He's a member of the Knesset and currently serves as leader of Hadash and head of the Joint List, a political alliance of four Arab-dominated parties. Here is an excerpt from a speech he gave at a conference sponsored by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in New York City.
Arab citizens comprise one-fifth of Israel's population. We cannot bring peace, democracy, and equality on our own, but neither can Israel reach peace, democracy, and equality without us. What does it mean to be unwanted? It is piercing stares when your fellow passengers on the bus hear you answer your phone in Arabic. It is sending out your CV to find a job, knowing that your Arab name will outweigh your academic achievements. It is when you are finally able to buy your first family home and your would-be neighbors take to the streets to protest you and 42 other families moving to the neighborhood. It is Prime Minister Netanyahu warning his supporters on election day that the Arabs are turning out in droves to the polling places, as if even your right to vote is a threat. It is when 100,000 citizens live with no water, no electricity, no government-supported schools, no national health care services, not even a paved road. In the Negev, Arab communities have lived since before the founding of the state, but the Israeli government refuses to recognize their villages. Tens of thousands of Israeli citizens in the Negev live under constant threat of expulsion from their lands. A demolition order is hanging over the heads of the people of Umm al-Hiran. The government plans to strip Umm al-Hiran of its Arab name and its Arab population and build a new Jewish community called Hiran in its place. This shows an ugly reality and a very hard truth. The village is not being destroyed because of its geography or planning issues. It is being destroyed because its Arab residents are unwanted. How can it be that I still have hope? This week, I met with African-American leaders in Atlanta, Georgia, the capital of America's Black Civil Rights Movement. I had the great privilege to visit the Ebenezer Baptist Church where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached. The Civil Rights Movement believed that black people and white people had to join together and struggle together to reach freedom and justice. I have hope because when the government tried to throw us out of the political process and deprive us of our rights, we chose to join together and struggle together. We established a joint list, Arab and Jewish. Instead of surrendering to segregation, we chose to lead the way to openness and inclusion. We at the Joint List are living proof that Arabs and Jews can refuse to be enemies. We at the joint list are living proof that Arabs and Jews can refuse to be enemies and that we can share our society as equals. The Netanyahu government is chipping away at what is left of Israel's democratic sphere, repressing freedom of speech and silencing dissent. In the last year, the government has threatened the independence of the Supreme Court and introduced laws to delegitimize human rights organizations. I don't accept the cynical arithmetic that says that all Jews must be against all Arabs and all Arabs against all Jews. I believe in the power of Arabs and Jews struggling together against racism and for democracy.
That was Arab-Israeli Knesset member Ayman Odeh speaking at a conference sponsored by the newspaper Haaretz in New York City. And that concludes our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us next Sunday when we will feature Palestinian journalist and professor Rami Khoury, speaking from Harvard University. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.